Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, I'm very serious about the news this week.
Why is that?
Well, it's because it's become very serious. The country is in the grip of a panic. The country doesn't know which way to turn, and I'm just talking about Michael Steele.
I don't think Michael Steele knows which way to turn.
No, we'll get back to Michael Steele, but I think first we should probably talk about some even bigger issues.
You don't mean the earmarks?
I mean the biggest issue that has ever faced our republic.
Pork?
It's the Omnibus Appropriations Act of 2009.
And we're all boys on the omnibus.
Let's just stop for one moment and consider,
and
where did
joke?
This omnibus come from?
Where'd it come from?
It came from last year. It is the creature from the past.
Because President Bush and the recalcitrant Congress could
the
not...
The 110th Congress. Ooh, I forgot
could not get their act together, and that's why it was done this week and not last week, and that's why it only ends on September 30th.
Last year, as it would normally be done before even the end of the federal fiscal year, which ended September 30th, 2008.
They could not agree.
And they packed it with a lot of things.
Well, there are thousands of earmarks. Is that fair to say?
Something like 8,000 earmarks.
And
an enormous number, perhaps a record number. And they do involve billions of dollars. But two things have to be said. Number one, this is a very, very small part of the overall bill.
Less than 2%. Just for the record, $7.7 billion out of a $410 billion package.
All right. But it still amounts to billions of dollars. Right. And the second thing that needs to be said is this is how appropriations bills have been passed for a very long time. We used to call it pork, now we call it earmarks, but things are put in the bill more transparently now than in the past. In the past, they were put in such ways you could never find them, took months to find them, couldn't trace them. But they're in there to benefit specific things in specific states and districts, and that's how votes are obtained to pass big controversial
right, and that's how congressmen
bills
are reelected as
exactly.
Well. But at the same time, we did hear two presidential candidates last year. Both of them said that they thought earmarks were getting out of control.
And both of them meant it to some degree. I think John McCain has made it much more a central part of his entire political persona to talk about earmarks. And probably had he been president this past week, he may have said, I don't want this omnibus appropriations bill because it's got 8,000 earmarks in it. Take it back and give me something that has no earmarks in it. And then what would have happened, Ken?
You wouldn't have had a spending bill.
That is correct. And that would then have resulted in what we saw in late 1995 and early 1996.
Shutting down the government or temporary spending expenses.
Temporary. Right. That's right. And perhaps then, after all of that pain and suffering and some more unemployment, which isn't exactly what very many people want right now, you might have had some form of earmark reform.
But it was interesting to see President Obama say that I am signing an imperfect bill, and I suspect that the next spending bill, which would be, I guess,
this fiscal year, October 1st,
right, will have far less earmarks.
Well, we'll see. We don't know the degree of Barack Obama's commitment to it because he clearly took the view that this was old business, this was George Bush business.
Let's get it out of the way now.
Let's get the carcass off the stage and let's move on to the next year, my budget. When we do get to Barack Obama's budget, then we'll find out. How does he really feel about confronting Congress over earmarks?
But one thing we are seeing that John McCain has not, like Douglas MacArthur did, has not faded away. He has become a serious player in this 111th Congress.
Yes, he has, and on the issues that he is best prepared on and ran on last fall. Now, there have been a couple of times he's also stood out and said, look, let's not battle over, for example, Hillary Clinton's appointment as Secretary of State. Let's try to unite behind the new president. And he was very supportive of Barack Obama's new policy on Iraq.
Right. Well, actually, probably more so than Democrats. And so in some ways, John McCain could be Barack Obama's best friend, sort of like Everett Dirksen with Lyndon Johnson, or as some people have even referred to, Wendell Willkie, who helped end the isolationism of the Republican Party, helping FDR go to war in 1941.
And Arthur Vandenberg, on the other end of the war in the late 40s, helping Harry Truman bring the United States into NATO and a lot of other international organizations supporting the United Nations.
We don't talk about Willkie or Vandenberg enough in this
not
podcast.
Not enough. Not nearly enough. But there are other battles percolating around this administration and this Congress with respect to our foreign policy. One had to do with an appointee who is going to be in a very important, sensitive intelligence position, gathering all the different intelligence reports and distilling them for presentation daily to the Director of National Intelligence, and that means directly on to the President. And he has taken his name out of consideration.
We're talking about Charles Freeman, who was appointed by, or was hoped to be appointed by Dennis Blair, the Director of
National Intelligence.
And Charles Freeman has taken not the Israel side.
He's taken a lot of positions that are friendly to Arab countries.
That's correct.
He's spent a lot of time in Arab countries.
Saudi Arabia.
He's worked for some of the Arab governments and entities. And he has some sympathy for the non-Israel position, whether that's a Palestinian point of view or an Arab point of view or an Islamic point of view. He has also generated some controversy with some of his statements about China, some of his associations with respect to the Chinese question.
There were some people who said that he acquiesced with the treatment of dissidents and Tiananmen Square.
And he made excuses for China after
Tiananmen. But it was really his views on Israel, I think, that was really touched off that raw nerve in American politics that people are more hesitant on taking on.
It's a sensitive point, and he seems to have hit it in a rather insensitive way by blaming his own problems on, quote, the Israel
lobby.
Well,
see, that's it. It's not. Right.
What does that phrase mean? How does that resonate
in the
conversation?
There are a lot of people who feel that he was rejected not because of he had the temerity to question Israel's role in the world, but his views were just completely one-sided. And it was anti-Israel, it was pro-Palestinian, it was pro-Arab, and he had this kind of rhetoric on Israel that was suspect in a lot of people.
He has essentially issued this accusation that groups of Israel sympathizers in this country had torpedoed him by putting out all kinds of false information about him, which some of the organizations he was probably talking about have denied.
Like AIPAC said, absolutely not. There was no lobbying on from our people at all on the Freeman nomination.
At the same time, it's very hard to imagine that someone who had acquired a reputation of touching some of these hot buttons and doing it perhaps in a ham-fisted way would certainly, when his name came up for a job of this sensitivity, attract a certain amount of reportage. And it might not have to come from AIPAC. It might not have to come from any organization or anybody with a hat on that says the name of an organization. It could come from any number of influential people, people in the Senate, people in the administration, people very close to Barack Obama could have said, ooh, I don't know, that name, that one's going to touch off
two things. If the Obama administration decided to nominate somebody who is overwhelmingly anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian, if they had done that, to put somebody like that in a sensitive intelligence position, I would argue, would be also a mistake. But even more importantly, Barack Obama knew during the campaign that, you know, when he backed away from Zbigniew Brzezinski, other people whose views on Israel had been suspect. Why would Dennis Blair, why would the Obama administration pick somebody like a Charles Freeman who has a history of comments hostile to Israel? Why would you put somebody that in your administration when you're already on the outs with so many people who have a certain point of view on that issue?
This was a sensitivity point. I wonder, you have to wonder, if the DNI, Dennis Blair, wasn't wondering if he needed to test how much independence he was going to have, and this looked like a pretty good way to do it, and floated that name out there, and pretty soon it sank.
Here's somebody else who may have gotten himself in hot water, who may be also on his way out, and that is
Michael Steele,
the chairman of the Republican National Committee.
It has not been a long and distinguished tenure for Chairman Steele.
Before we go to the current brouhaha involving Chairman Steele, let's just remind the listener
Review the bidding.
When three Republicans decided to vote for the stimulus package, Arlen Inspector, Olympia Snowe, and Susan Collins, Michael Steele suggested, well, maybe we should challenge them in the primary.
Maybe we should run against them in the primary. Not good Republicans.
Then he also had something to say about Rush Limbaugh. I don't know if you heard that.
Some people mentioned that. That came across my screen.
The latest this week is an interview in GQ, which is Congressional Quarterly magazine.
No, it's Gentleman's Quarterly.
Gentleman's Quarterly, where he seemed to take a pro-choice view on abortion.
He said independent choice. He believed in independent choice. And he has said things in the past that have led people to wonder where he stood on that issue. In fact, there are those who felt in the past that he was a moderately pro-choice Republican.
He seems to be, every time he gets himself in the news, first of all, it seems to be followed by an apology, and he apologized for the GQ thing.
Right away,
well, I'm really pro-life.
On his knees.
Yeah.
I don't think those apologies are helping him. I think the apology for the Rush Limbaugh remarks was probably as bad as the Rush Limbaugh remarks because it made him look servile.
Yeah, right.
Well, let's just say that the podcast is being recorded on Thursday, as we usually do, and I think we need to say that because I'm not sure Michael Steele will be chairman of the Republican Party for the remainder of the time this podcast is current.
That is further than I'm willing to go.
I think he resigns and resigns soon.
But even if a no-confidence vote succeeds, who replaces Michael Steele?
Someone who is unquestionably anti-abortion. I just don't think you can be chairman of the Republican National Committee and not be just absolutely unequivocally anti-abortion.
Now, even though Michael Steele says, I am absolutely pro-life, I mean,
I understand that, but he slides into this other language too readily.
He does.
And it suggests clearly to people that he is ambivalent on the subject personally, and that while he is loyal to, you know, big salute to the Republican platform, it's not in his heart. that bothers a lot of the people in the Republican Party, especially the kind of people who are right now feeling an urgent need for a strong leader for the Republican Party nationally.
Saul Anuzis, remember him?
Yes.
Michigan Republican state chairman who finished third or fourth in the top six. Maybe the next chairman of the RNC. The bad news for the Republicans isn't limited to the United States of America. It also goes down to the individual states as well. Let's say Minnesota, for example.
Now, and this is an interesting situation that's arisen in Minnesota. It now appears that the legal proceedings have not opened any daylight for Norm Coleman, and it appears that the process will end in the next several days with the state of Minnesota determining that Al Franken won that Senate election.
The three-judge panel heard 5 weeks of testimony from Norm Coleman. They heard 1 week of testimony from Al Franken. Norm Coleman tried to bring back 1,725 rejected absentee ballots. The three-judge panel may, as soon as next week, say, you know what, ladies and gentlemen, Al Franken may have won this race. Now, of course, the Democrats in Washington desperately won a 50
Democratic vote, get him closer to 60.
Right, and so they'll seat him, and they may very well seat him, or at least attempt to seat him, but one that will probably take 60 votes, and they don't have 60 votes.
Especially not without Al Franken.
And two, Norm Coleman is probably not going to agree or acquiesce to this decision by the three-judge panel.
He can go to what further?
Well, they can go to the state Supreme Court, and if they say no, they can go
because
to the U.S.
state Supreme Court has supplied the panel that is making all these other decisions. They are all themselves justices on that court, so it's very unlikely they're going to be released.
Then you go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and of course, everybody will remember what happened in 2000 when what happened in 2000?
Well, Antonin Scalia took the case from Florida. He convinced enough of his colleagues, four other colleagues, to take the case of Bush v. Gore and essentially told the state of Florida to stop recounting and to declare George W. Bush the victor of its electoral vote, and that made George W. Bush president. It was a 5-4 decision, and of course, one of the most controversial and notorious decisions ever made by the Supreme Court.
Notorious meaning?
Notorious meaning that it changed the relationship between many of the justices, and it changed, if you will, the integrity of the position that had so often been taken by the conservative majority that they should not be reversing states.
Right.
That if states had a clear line of jurisprudence and they were moving towards a certain decision, they shouldn't interfere with that. Here, they clearly saw an overriding concern, which was they thought there wouldn't be a clear presidential winner and they thought the court had to essentially pick one.
The court is perhaps, if anything, more conservative than it was in 2000.
Yes.
And the question is whether the courts learned from what happened in 2000 and may not get involved.
And it's also a smaller matter. It's not the presidency
true.
Of the United States. It's not the guy who's going to pick their successors.
Right.
It is just another Senate seat. Let's back up just a little bit here. What happens, whatever the courts may decide, if the Democrats try to seat Al Franken and the Republicans just say no?
You know who that will not help? Tim Pawlenty.
That is correct. He's got to be back there, the symbol of the Republican Party in Minnesota, and this is the Republican Party that refuses to seat duly elected Minnesotans in the United States
Senate. Pawlenty may or may not run for a third term in 2010, but we do know that he's very interested in 2012 when another job comes open, and Pawlenty's obviously standing back home would certainly be hurt if the feeling among voters, and I haven't seen this in polls yet because actually one poll showed that 46% of Minnesotans do want a do-over in the election. 45% said no.
So I think the precedent of having do-overs of elections that are very close and therefore hard to count would be not well received by the United States Senate in general. There's also a Senate seat that is about to be in question in 2010 that is held by Arlen Specter, and Arlen Specter is in trouble with a lot of Republicans, too.
I think if the election were held today, Arlen Specter would win another term, but will he be renominated by the Republican Party?
I say no.
I say no also. It's a May 2010 primary. He's one of the three Republicans who voted on the stimulus plan. Whatever he intends to vote on, card check or anything like that.
Card check being the labor union's favorite bill, which makes it easier for people to form a union.
Exactly. Pat Toomey, the former congressman who's the head of Club for Growth, who came within 17,000 votes of Arlen Specter 5 years ago in the 2004 primary. Back then, Arlen Specter had President Bush, had Rick Santorum.
Rick Santorum being the much more conservative other senator from Pennsylvania at the time.
And both were kind of popular at the time, neither of whom are popular now or still in office now. I suspect that if Toomey does run again, and I think he will beat Arlen Specter in the primary, even though I suspect also that there's no way that Toomey can win statewide.
Well, let's put it this way. If Arlen Specter wants to do the Republican Party a big favor right now, probably the best thing he could do would be to retire. And there would be the possibility then that a stronger candidate candidate for the Republican Party would emerge other than Pat Toomey.
Like a Tom Ridge. I'm not saying it's going to be Tom Ridge.
Tom Ridge would be an excellent choice.
But somebody who the establishment could rally behind, somebody less incendiary than an Arlen Specter.
Either way, the party's better off, because if Specter runs, Toomey either beats him in the primary or weakens him substantially, and some Democrat could pick either one of them off, in theory, at least, in November of 2010.
There are other primaries to watch, of course. Roland Burris, the latest poll I saw in Illinois, Roland Burris is getting 5% of Democratic support.
My question is, who is that one Democrat who does still support Roland Burris?
Would it be Roland Burris? Right.
A very sad story for Illinois. It does appear that Roland Burris is going to serve out this 2 years, resisting all calls for his resignation, even from his own Democratic colleagues. And so he will serve it out. He will obviously not win renomination. It will be some other Democrat. What other Democrat will it be? Ken, are you betting on Jan Schakowsky?
No. Well, there's somebody, Alexei Giannoulias.
Yes.
Who is the state treasurer.
Very young person. Just
very young,
over
very
30
rich.
Years.
He seems to be the choice of Dick Durbin. They traveled together to Greece and the rest of Europe during the congressional break. But there are some ethics questions about Giannoulias as well.
Yes, and he will probably not be free entirely from the Blagojevich taint, because he's had some truck with the governor who hasn't in the state of Illinois Democratic Party. So there are going to be questions there.
There are Tony Rezko connections as well.
Good old Tony Rezko. We haven't talked about him in almost a year. And once Barack Obama got past his besmirchment with some association with Tony Rezko, the guy faded out. But now he's going to be back, and he'll be back in terms of that Senate election. The Republicans are probably going to nominate Mark Kirk.
Probably. And I think they have a chance of picking up that seat. But look, anybody, if it's Burris, it's not going to be Burris. If it's Burris, the Republicans.
Burris.
Yeah, right, exactly. But, you know, Bill Daley, the former Secretary of Commerce, the brother of the mayor, apparently the smarter of the two Daleys.
Yeah, he's considered to be very smart, but you've seen him address a crowd, correct?
Not the most exciting. So anyway, that's another primary. And, of course, Kirsten Gillibrand as well has another. Scott Stringer.
Now we're up in the state of New York.
In New York. Another appointed senator, another one with a primary battle coming up. Scott Stringer, the borough president of Manhattan.
Maybe not the strongest opponent.
No, but I should tell you that in 1976, Scott Stringer and I traded buttons together in Manhattan. Okay, so not only Carolyn Maloney, Jerry Nadler, two congressmen from Manhattan, Carolyn McCarthy, whose husband was murdered on the Long Island Railroad, a congresswoman from Long Island, is also threatening Gillibrand. Now, Hillary Clinton's people are working hard, as they are the Schumer people, hard for Gillibrand. So right now, the polls don't look great. A lot of people want to take her on. But I suspect that as Gillibrand gets better known, she may be a stronger candidate than people think.
Plus, she has some safety in numbers. If all those people run against her and they split the anti-Gillibrand vote, she could probably get the nomination with something well under 50%.
But if it's New York City versus the rest of the state, then she could be in trouble, because the last senator from outside of New York, of course, was Charles Goodell, who was appointed, and the last elected senator from outside of New York was Kenneth Keating in 1958. I suspect New York feels very proprietary about their senators being from the five boroughs or thereabouts.
That's where the Democrats are. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.